the perfect storm occurs and you go back and you have to reassess, and hopefully you avoid this from ever happening again in the future.
Anchorage Assembly members react to the report on problems with the municipal election. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 2nd. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a boat, likely from the Japanese tsunami, washes up on a southeast beach.
It was probably about 100 feet from the tree line, and it looked like it had just actually showed up there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The long-awaited report by an independent investigator on the troubled April 3rd municipal election in Anchorage is out. It blames the election debacle, including widespread ballot shortages that kept an estimated hundreds of voters from casting ballots, on bad management at the clerk's office. KSKA's Dacia Eaton has more.
The investigator hired by the Anchorage Assembly says he found no evidence of any intent by municipal employees or election workers to unfairly influence the outcome of the election. Instead, he finds two main things led to problems on election night: what he calls a hands-off management style by the municipal clerk, and a deputy clerk with limited experience. Attorney Dan Hensley, a retired Alaska Superior Court judge, issued the report. He did not return phone calls by deadline. Assembly Chair Ernie Hall says he was not surprised that most of the blame fell on former municipal clerk Barbara Grunstein.
Barbara had shared with me that she hadn't been as involved in this election as she should have been. If she had been more on top of what was going on, would have probably been able to prevent it happening.
The Anchorage Assembly hired Hensley in May. The deputy clerk, Jacqueline Duke, was fired May 9th. Grunstein gave her resignation May 29th. The report confirms that 65 out of 121 polling places ran out of ballots, and that as early as 2 p.m. on election day, election workers were calling with concerns about running short. Mayor Dan Sullivan easily won re-election, and none of the races were close enough to be reversed by ballot shortages. The report suggests the municipal clerk's office staff was stretched thin on election day, but does not blame staff cuts. Hall.
What it states in this report is he didn't think understaffing was what caused the problem. He thought that having the additional part-time help would probably have made a difference. But as far as the election going awry because of understaffing, he didn't think that was true.
Hensley notes that close to 300 voters either left in frustration or were sent to other polling places because of the ballot shortage. He acknowledges that an email sent by Jim Minnery with the Alaska Family Council exacerbated the ballot shortage problem, but said it was not the primary cause for the shortage. The email incorrectly advised constituents that they could register at the polls on election day to vote against Proposition 5, a ballot initiative to strengthen the municipality's Equal Rights Act. Hall says the Assembly is considering making such interference in elections a punishable crime.
It's not currently, but that doesn't mean that it couldn't be made so. It would be a misdemeanor of some sort. We've had conversations about it and what the probability was of this occurring again in the future, and it's still a topic of discussion with the election committee.
Hensley made 6 recommendations to the Assembly in his report, including more hands-on management, better training for election workers, and more Assembly oversight of the clerk's office. But he did not recommend any specific plan on how to distribute the required ballots in the future.
That was surprising to me. We've just come out of an election that went badly, and it went badly because we didn't have ballots in the right place.
Hall says he'll push for a new distribution formula despite the report. In conclusion, Hensley writes, quote, "This year's ballot shortage was the combination of several events unlikely to occur in the same combination in the future, especially if other recommended changes are made in the municipal clerk's office," end quote. In short, it was a perfect storm. Assembly Chair Ernie Hall agrees.
The longer it goes and everything's fine, everybody gets a little more complacent. A committee's dropped here, a committee's dropped there, and then the perfect storm occurs, and you go back and you have to reassess and make sure that you get municipal code changed and protocols put into place that hopefully you avoid this from ever happening again in the future.
There is an Anchorage Assembly work session to review the report on September 7th. Hensley is planning a follow-up report in about 2 weeks. The Assembly agreed to pay Hensley up to $35,000 for the 9-page report. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A slightly slower start to the fire season in Alaska has allowed the state to loan some of its fire crews to the lower 48 for the time being. The Alaska Fire Service says 5 crews of firefighters have gone to Wyoming. Public Affairs Specialist Mel Slater explains.
What we had originally scheduled was a jet load of crews that were supposed to go to Salt Lake City, Utah to support a fire there. But while en route, they were reassigned to a fire in Wyoming.
5 crews includes just over 100 firefighters and their equipment, according to Slater. Fires are raging all over the West right now. Montana has 10 large wildfires burning. Utah's largest wildfire has consumed more than 150 square miles. And there are reports of large fires currently burning in Nevada, Idaho, New Mexico, and Wyoming. The Colorado Springs wildfire is reported 55% contained. So far this year, Slater says firefighters in Alaska have had a slightly slower season than usual.
From a historical perspective, we have had less fires this year than in previous years. We just completed action on Allakaket over the weekend, so we have one fire that's being addressed right now.
That's the Bear Creek Fire, 13 miles southwest of Anderson. It has burned more than 8,000 acres. Slater says officials determined what amount of personnel and equipment could be loaned out while still maintaining what is needed for response efforts in Alaska. 4 more crews from Alaska are slated to depart for Wyoming on Wednesday. A Japanese fishing skiff thought to be debris from the March 2011 tsunami there has washed up on an Annette Island beach near Metlakatla in southeast. Michelle Gunya and her husband Mark were beachcombing on Saturday when they saw the boat beached on the south end of the island.
It was probably about 100 feet from the tree line, and it looked like it had just actually showed up there. Maybe the night before, because all the growth was still moving around and it was still alive.
The Japanese characters for Kaiho Maru on the bow were translated by a local Japanese speaker to mean pleasant treasure.
And we had one of the guys come up and take a look at it, one of the Japanese guys, and he kept telling my husband, most definitely this boat came from Japan.
But the find was somewhat less than pleasant.
It had like kind of little white worms on it. And then it looked like mussels, but they were kind of orange with a whitish tint to them. And I've never seen them before. We just thought they were maybe a different type of mussel, you know, from being out in the ocean and everything.
Gunya says they contacted the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration immediately about the find. The couple then had it towed to their shop.
We kind of looked at each other after we did some scraping and thought, let's take it out to the shop where it's not going to stink up the whole town, because we live right downtown in the middle of town. So it doesn't smell very nice right now.
Gunya says NOAA has requested pictures of the boat and its exact location when found. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bethel residents get their fill of fast food for a day.
I want the special taco.
I want the new taco.
What's the new taco?
I forgot.
Dorito tacos.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
One of Alaska's U.S. senators is questioning recent threats from the IRS to the state's air taxi operators. KDLG's Ariel Van Cleve has the story.
Senator Mark Begich says the IRS is attempting to retroactively collect taxes from the operators, and in response, he sent a letter to Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner requesting a meeting to discuss the issue. Begich Press Secretary Julie Haskett says owner-operators have been coming to the senator over the last few months with complaints about IRS audits.
They've been operating under a certain sort of set of rules and understandings for some time now, and then the IRS has come in and said, well, actually, we think you fall under a different set of rules and you owe us all this money. And in some cases, it's over $1 million in back taxes they're trying to collect. So we're trying to, Senator Begich is trying through this letter to Secretary Geithner to say, this is very important. It seems like the IRS is using heavy-handed tactics to basically scare these operators. And we need to sit down and talk about what exactly is going on here.
She says the owners of more on-demand operations are the ones who seem to be having the most trouble.
It's the smaller folks who get a call, take them out to a lake or a fishing spot or a hunting spot. It's these smaller operators who generally are operating at the margins anyway, don't have a lot of extra cash, that this is impacting the most.
Begich points out in the letter that, quote, while excise taxes do exist for many modes of scheduled air carrier service, exemptions are available for certain types of operations common in Alaska, including seaplanes, sightseeing, and small aircraft operating on non-established lines. Alaska Air Carriers Association Executive Director Joy Jernay says the issue is complex, and while many operators understand how the FAA defines their business, they are not as clear on the IRS terminology. According to FAA rules, flights are either labeled as scheduled or unscheduled, but the IRS defines flights as an established line or between two points, and float planes are exempt.
In Alaska, if you are going to fly from Anchorage to Western Alaska and you're in a small aircraft, you're going to go through Lake Clark Pass. Or if you're traveling in another direction, you're going to go through Isabella Pass. The mountains, the topography dictate how you're going to fly. To the IRS, you flew 12 times through that same route, therefore it's an established route for your company and you should be collecting taxes.
She says operators collected tax by one set of rules for the last 49 years, and this is a new interpretation of the taxing code by the IRS.
Our guess as an association is that this type of shift is occurring because of the current economic climate in the United States and across the world.
Jernay says larger companies are not having these problems because they already have established ways of collecting their taxes and understand the policies. She says the real damage is done to small rural operators.
Of the carriers that we represent who have been audited in the last 2 years, over half of them are considering bankruptcy because of the fines levied against them. They are that the fines are $250,000 to $1.8 million just for the last 3 years.
Jernay says the association is concerned Alaska is receiving the brunt of the threats because there's so much air traffic, but they have heard from operators in other states, such as Hawaii, who are dealing with the same issues. So far, the association has sent letters to IRS officials and has gotten the attention of Alaska's federal lawmakers. Jernay says she hopes a deal can be reached with the IRS so they can avoid bringing the issues to the legislative stage, but she isn't optimistic.
The IRS does not have a reputation for being responsive or being helpful in terms of clarifying and cleaning things up.
She says she is especially concerned about what extra taxes could mean for air taxi customers. Haskett says she believes Senator Begich's letter has given operators the confidence to come forward.
Folks are afraid of the IRS. People don't want to create turmoil when an IRS agent is auditing you. So they've been somewhat quiet. But now that we've put our letter out to Geithner and it's getting some circulation, even more operators are coming out of the woodwork.
She says she isn't sure when the senator could hear back from either Secretary Geithner or officials at the IRS. In Dillingham, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
Yukon River communities are getting creative in coping with another poor king salmon return. A fish-sharing arrangement between Yukon River fishermen is aimed at protecting the king's stock while still providing some of the prized fish for subsistence. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Amonok-based Quipak Fisheries, a Yukon Delta area village-owned processor, is providing salmon to two communities upriver in the Yukon Flats.
They put them in a box and they sent it up free of charge and everything. so it helps out.
That's Fort Yukon Tribal Government Natural Resources Director Rocky James. James says locals are concerned about this summer's weak king run, and some have agreed not to fish in exchange for bycatch kings harvested in the Yukon Delta commercial chum salmon fishery.
Making a personal sacrifice not to fish this year, and I think it's important to understand and to look back on that for our future generations, for our kids.
James says foregoing fishing in the Yukon Flats will help get more kings to upstream spawning grounds. Some residents of nearby Stevens Village are also participating in the project with Quipoc. Company manager Jack Schulteis says they've provided fish to upriver villages on an informal basis in the past. Schulteis says the new program was developed this spring with the Tanana Chiefs Conference and the Council of Athabascan Tribal Governments in light of another bleak king salmon forecast.
What we're trying to do is still have a commercial fishery for chum salmon and also address the need for subsistence fish upriver. So I guess you could say it's a win-win situation on both sides.
Schulteis says a first shipment of salmon caught in a test fishery at the Delta was well received at Fort Yukon. He's optimistic about more villages signing on to the program as long as there's enough commercial chum openings near the Yukon Delta.
If they hold us up from commercial fishing, then this isn't going to work at all. You know, because we wouldn't have any incidental fish to send upriver. That's definitely the key to this.
Schulteis says fishery managers are supportive of the sharing program. Andrew Furman, a natural resources technician with the Council of Athabascan Tribal Governments, says the project is a way to alleviate fish fights between up and downriver communities and commercial and subsistence fishermen.
A lot of it's to be a good neighbor and to build relationships along the river that previously weren't there, because there's a lot of in-river fighting and finger-pointing at people. And it's also, you know, help us help them. It's good following around because if they get a commercial opener, then they get their fish, they get their money, and then we get fish in exchange.
Furman says the arrangement also makes economic sense. He says with gas going for between $7 and $9 a gallon, some subsistence fishermen are happy not to run their boats chasing a limited number of kings. He says 10 Fort Yukon fishermen have signed up so far to participate in the program with Quipoc. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska state troopers say they ended separate searches for two missing Southeast residents because they ran out of options. Spokeswoman Megan Peters says there's no more information on the whereabouts of Wrangell's Colin Bunis and Hyder's Kathleen Curry.
It gets to a point when you're searching for an individual where there's no evidence to show you that you're searching in the right place or that you're searching in the wrong place. It just gets to a standstill. And at some point, searches do have to end.
Wrangell's Bunis was reported overdue last Monday. The 25-year-old had planned a hiking and kayaking trip on the Stikine River and one of its tributaries. Searchers found his kayak in a logjam, as well as some of his gear, but Peter says no other evidence turned up.
They were doing aerial searches, they were searching on the ground, and they were also doing water searches. We were searching for every possibility. We were searching for the possibility that he made it out of the water and was attempting self-rescue to hike out. We were searching for the possibility that he never made it out of the river as well.
Bunis, an Army National Guard sergeant, was an experienced hiker and kayaker. He last reported his whereabouts Friday, June 22nd, using a location device. The search for Curry, age 60, began Monday, June 25th, after Hyder residents reported her missing.
It's a very large area, and with not finding any signs of an individual to tell you to keep looking in one area versus another area, it's not conducive to a search environment. We need to find something to tell us we're on the right trail.
Both searchers were called off on Friday afternoon.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The state has been working for nearly a year to revamp its animal health care regulations. The Office of the State Veterinarian hosted the last in a series of public workshops Monday to discuss the draft. To date, the state doesn't have an established guideline when it comes to health care for horses and livestock, birds and exotic animals, or domestic animals like sled dogs. Many critics anticipated heated discussions between animal rights advocates and the state when it came time to discuss sled dog care, but Gerlach says overall, interested parties have remained calm.
When people came in and were upset about the draft standards, in many cases it was because they hadn't been able to read through all the documentation and all the material that we had out online for people. In most cases, I think we've had an overwhelming amount of support for our efforts.
Gerlach says mushers and sled dog advocacy groups have taken an active role in responding to the state's draft proposal. He says the new regulations should not change the face of races like the Yukon Quest or the Iditarod.
We worked with mushers, and we worked with the Iditarod Trail Committee, as well as the folks from Mush with Pride, to go ahead and incorporate the standards that they use in our basic standards. The other point is the way the statutes have been written, our animal care standards can't override or can't nullify what is normally accepted is in the mushing community as a standard.
Gerlach says a reworked version of the state's animal care standards will be released for the public this summer. His office aims to release a final document and implement the new regulations this fall. 54 mushers are already signed up for the 2013 Iditarod. Registration began on Saturday. So far, the field includes 9 rookies and plenty of familiar faces. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
Some of the more notable names signed up for the 2013 race include reigning champion Dallas Seavey, 4-time winners Lance Mackey, Martin Boozer, and Jeff King, as well as 2011 champion John Baker. There are still some bigger names who aren't on the list yet, but Iditarod Communications Director Aaron McLarnon says that's not too unusual.
We haven't seen Rick Swenson sign up. We haven't seen Hugh Neff sign up. Those are a couple of the larger names that we haven't seen cross our paths yet. But it's not rare for people not to sign up on that first day.
McLarnon says this year's first day registration numbers topped last year's 46 entrants. Among the rookies in next year's race is Luan Ramos Marquez, the Iditarod's first ever musher from Brazil. Jamaica's Newton Marshall, who finished the 2010 Iditarod in 47th place and scratched in 2011, will also give the race another try next year after taking 2012 off. Those who signed up Saturday will be the first to draw their numbers at the Mushers Banquet in February, guaranteeing them a number and starting place between 2 and 55. McLarnon says the different registration deadlines are something racers take into account when planning their race.
When those mushers depart from the start line, there's actually kind of strategy to when they want to leave.
The final deadline for registration is November 30th. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
For the full list of racers who signed up for the first day, go to alaskapublic.org. The isolated city of Bethel has no roads in or out, but that didn't stop a major fast food chain from delivering enough food to feed the entire town. As KYUK's Mark Earhart reports, much of the town witnessed one of the grandest spectacles in the community's recent memory, a Taco Bell truck flying in by helicopter.
First, we all were like waiting across the street.
That's 13-year-old Natalie Dementeth.
And then a helicopter came. And it landed like right in front of the library place.
It's something you'd see on Hollywood backlot, a helicopter literally suspending a panel truck from about a 50-foot cable, an event that represents some special cargo for the crowd, which gathers by the hundreds. That's right, it's the Mexican-inspired sensation that's sweeping the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Bethel made national news because of a hoax. Bogus flyers were posted around town that advertised a Taco Bell franchise that was never going to come. So the company decided to send Bethel a little something special.
It's like 3,500 pounds of beef.
That's Taco Bell's chief marketing officer, Brian Nickel, who says the news of the hoax brought Bethel a jet full of Taco Bell executives, a video and social media crew, and over 10,000 free tacos.
I can't remember how many packets of hot sauce we brought, but you're not going to be short on hot sauce either.
The scene is nothing short of complex as a team scrambles to assemble the tacos while a makeshift security detail keeps hungry patrons across the street away from the truck's landing site. Once landed squarely in the parking lot, servers get in the truck and start passing out tacos.
Looks like a Dorito chip with taco meat, lettuce, and tomato and cheese on it. Pretty good.
That's Gary Watson. He's unwrapping the only kind of taco available, the Doritos Locos Taco, a dish that since its debut a few months ago has seen a relentless marketing campaign and sales to match. It's an entree that even had the attention of a pair of young girls, 6-year-old Bethany Nicholson and her sister, 3-year-old Natalie.
I want the special taco. I want the new taco.
What's the new taco?
I forgot. Dorito tacos. I want Dorito tacos too, with cheese on them.
The fast food chain's marketing team is out in full force with expensive cameras and large fuzzy microphones. It even includes a pair of music video directors who have worked with the likes of Lady Gaga and Vampire Weekend. All this corporate hubbub doesn't go unnoticed. Diane McAkron, standing a little bit down the road, holds up a large piece of cardboard.
I have a sign here that says 10,000 kings, not tacos.
She says she won't be unwrapping a taco anytime soon. She thinks people should be focused more on the Kuskokwim River's depleting king salmon numbers.
And I think we need a lot of time and attention to why that's happening and how to help people.
On this day, McAkron is definitely in the minority. People have been lining up for hours, even signing release forms so they can be filmed in exchange for the free tacos.
So that Taco Bell can do this for their own commercial purposes. So they're getting really millions of dollars worth of advertising just by this event, and there's not even a Taco Bell in Bethel.
And that's a fact that Taco Bell officials say won't be changing anytime soon. That doesn't seem to bother the waves of people who are showing up on this overcast afternoon. Many like Kimberly Nicholson, who says she's happy to have a Taco Bell in town, even if it's just for one day.
Stuff like this does not happen to small towns like Bethel. So this is going to be something that's going to be talked about for a very, very long time.
In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org or follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Dave Benninger and Ariel Van Cleve in Dillingham, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Josh Edge reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Think safety when out boating or doing activities near water. When boating, always wear a personal flotation device. Bring some kind of communication with you and do not overload the boat. Let family or friends know where you're going and when you plan to return. Find out more at alaskaboatingsafety.org and pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Injury Prevention Program. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.